Hi, I'm going to talk for a few minutes today and either get all the way through something or part way through something, and if we don't finish, we'll go ahead another time. So the occasion for this, like a lot of things that happened here, was something that came up in a talk that John Sutherland gave. We actually played it a couple months ago, and I was going to follow right up on it when it was really fresh in everybody's mind, but that's clearly not the case anymore. She gave a talk called Meaning and Consolation, and my subtitle for that talk, I guess, would be a koan that we've heard sometimes. The student comes in and says, but what about when it's a disaster? And the teacher just says, that's it. So Joan was talking in this talk about what she called a time of trouble. It was a few years ago that the talk was given, and it was about a year after the economy imploded and so on. And she was talking about, on a really massive scale, all kinds of crises that seemed too big to get a handle on. And then in a kind of dark magic, it turned out that closer to hand in her sangha and other people that she knew, it was just a time full of trouble, so multiply interconnected and just so vast that there didn't seem to be any way to come up with an adequate coping strategy. So you couldn't ignore it, you couldn't escape from it, you couldn't make a separate piece from it because it was so interconnected and there wasn't any way of fixing it. And predictably, she said there was a koan that would be a nice way to begin thinking about that. And here's the koan, which I think most of us know. A student comes to the teacher and says, when the heat and cold come, how can I avoid them? And Dongshan says, helpfully, go to the place where there's no heat and cold. Which sounds a lot like what we might want from meditation as a kind of way out of those things. And so the student, cheered up and anticipating the answer that will help him, says, what is the place where there's no heat and cold? And Dongshan says, in a time of cold, let the cold kill you. In a time of heat, let the heat kill you. And as Joan says, probably not the answer that the student was looking for. And what's lurking there is the notion that when the really big stuff happens, maybe it's not so useful to resist, it's not so useful to try to fend it off or to try to cope with it, that at least initially our way is to just let that flood you, to have no separation between you and that difficulty, whether it's large or small. That's certainly a lot of how we work with koans, I think probably in most koan schools, but certainly in ours. So we don't say solve the koan, it's not a riddle. We don't say, you have to get a handle on it. What we say is that you let the koan in, you see how it works on you, you see what it can show you if you give yourself up to it. And one of the things I think about koan practice is that doing that a lot, to some extent, at least intermittently, gives you some capacity to do that outside the world of working with koans as well. Something's difficult, can't get a handle on, you can just be open to it and see what it has to tell you. A couple months ago now in the beginners group, a little story came nicely to hand that really condenses some of this for me. We were working on the koan that we've worked on here a couple of times that seems to really speak to people. This is the stone drenched with rain that points the way. And this one woman, the second time we sat with it, said that something interesting had happened, that the first time we'd sat with it, the stone was kind of silly. It was a little, it was like a spin, she didn't say spin the bottle, but it was like a little stone that was going around in a circle pointing to different ways, and there was something kind of comic about it. She said this time when we sat with it, all of a sudden the stone was really massive. It was this really big stone, and all she could do was to sit down next to it. She said it wasn't manageable and that she couldn't try to manage it. And I think that notion of sitting down right next to or right in the midst of something that really isn't manageable and not trying to manage it is really at the heart of a lot of what we do. I think that's true certainly of the big Dharmakaya koans, the big emptiness koans that we work on, that in some way or another lead you to a direct experience of the vastness or emptiness or the shining eternal aspect of everything. You don't sit down and try to wangle with the koan until it will give you that. You just sit with whatever it presents, which is often something conspicuously unmanageable, and you don't try to manage it. There's a book I like. I'm ambivalent about the book, which is called Ambivalent Zen by Larry Schoenberg. But he's talking about a wonderful teacher that he had in Soho in New York, a Japanese teacher, who at some point says to him, Zen isn't about wisdom, Larry-san, it's about courage. And so this would be part of that aspect of our practice. I want to insist again that our practices are practices, and that a lot of the time, of course, there's nothing wrong with trying to manage stuff. I mean, we get along pretty well sometimes by doing that, but it's the Groucho and the cigar thing again, you know, that sometimes I like my cigar too, but sometimes I take it out of my mouth. So I think that sitting down and not trying to manage it is certainly the way that we learn to work with, again, those big emptiness koans, the first several Dharmakaya koans. I'd also want to suggest, and I don't know if we'll get there today, that it, paradoxically, maybe it's also our way of sitting with karmic stuff, of sitting with recalcitrant, difficult material in our own lives, which in some way we want to cope with and manage, that we hold off and don't try to manage it. And there's time today, I'll try and come back and talk a little bit more about that, but we'll just see. You know. So in terms of the Dharmakaya koans, I'm going to just read a few of them in a second. But just by way of a kind of analogy, there's this wonderful, you guys know the Australian director Peter Weir, do you know his movies? There's a great movie called The Last Wave, which is kind of a mystery story that he tells. And there's a lawyer who works with Aboriginal groups, and it looks like the Aboriginal tribe that he's working with has this really important secret that they don't want him to know, and he decides at some point, he gets sort of, you know, racially paranoid and decides actually that they're trying to, you know, kill all the white people and throw them out of Australia or something like that. And it turns out that they don't want him to know the secret, not because he might be able to do something to ward off the terrible thing they're trying to do, but just because it's taboo in the tribe for non-tribal members to know this material. And it turns out at the end of the movie, which is really wonderful, the movie's called The Last Wave, right? At the end, he's standing on the beach, he finally realizes what's what, and this enormous tidal wave comes that's gonna completely flood and destroy all of Australia, you know? And so what he realizes at that moment is that the secret was a sacred student, that it was in the sort of prophecies and lore of the tribe, and then in fact, there was nothing to be done about it at all. You know, it's a great thing because it's got the kind of detective quality. You know, if I can only figure it out, I can avoid it. And right at the end, he figures it out. And what he figures out is it's completely unavoidable. It's so vast that, you know, all I can do is let it engulf me. And I don't think all of our koans are quite that cataclysmic, but in some way they are about something that's pretty cataclysmic. So there's that. All right. So I just want to give you a few of these koans, and most of them are things that have come up fairly recently in the group. And I think they all have that quality of, to work on the koan would be, you know, we say that everything that comes up when you're working on the koan is part of the field of the koan. So a lot of these koans are likely to provoke that sense of, you know, I'm not buying it, I want to figure out a way to jimmy the thing so it doesn't appear as vast and unmanageable. And then the process of working with the koan is allowing something else to happen. So. One really daunting and wonderful one, there's a great talk that we played, again, a couple months ago now, but another sensei in open source, Sarah Bender, gave this really beautiful and moving talk about sitting with her mother and going through her mother's death. And she said that at the time, this is one part of the talk, but that a koan came to her and it really startled her because it wasn't a koan that she'd ever liked, and she sort of didn't know why it came, and then it came to really allow her to see a certain part of the situation. And the koan, which is from a much larger mondo, is just, it's like a mosquito trying to bite an iron ox. And for her, that was something about, you know, what could she do to help her mother through her death, or how could she come to terms with it, or wasn't there some way she could deal with her own feelings or something like that? And it was finally just all of that, you know, it's just, it's like a mosquito trying to bite an iron ox. And just to be with that, without resistance, open something up for her. Then there's another koan that we've done with Joan that Jen brought in, I think, last time as part of the koan seminar. So this is another one, you know, not a lot to be done here to wiggle out of what's being brought to our attention. A student asked Dashui, "It's clear that the fire at the end of the kalpa will completely destroy the universe. I'm still not clear whether there's something that won't be destroyed. And I love that I'm still not clear, because it's like this sort of abstract intellectual question, as if I have no personal stake in the answer, but I'm still not clear whether there's something that won't be destroyed. Dashu said, it won't be destroyed. And then the student, as if being a good student, asks, it'll follow along with everything else? It'll follow along with everything else, said Dashu. And so part of the process of sitting with that koan, I think, is, you know, being that student, you know, I'm still not clear whether there isn't so, whether there's something that won't be destroyed. Are you sure that that was the right answer? It'll actually follow along with everything else. It'll follow along with everything else. And then there's a sort of more local postscript to that part of the koan that I think is important. The student didn't accept Dashu's response, so he left and went to the teacher, Tosi, to whom he recounted this conversation. Tosi turned to his altar, lit incense, bowed to the Buddha, and said, the ancient Buddha of Sichuan has appeared, referring to Dashu. Then he turned to the student and said, you should go back there as fast as you can and make amends for your mistake. The student hurried back to Dashu, but Dashu was already dead. He returned to Tosi, but Tosi had died too. It's sort of a joke, but it's a really strange joke, you know. So lurking there is just, you know, three people who will all die talking to one another. And so the kalpa ending fire has something to do with that too. I always think it's about this koan that Hakuin says that the student is being offered a method to change his very bones, though it turns out it's actually about the letting the heat and cold kill you, but they're koans that are very similar in some respects. So I think that's important, that the koans like this are offering us a method to change our very bones. And part of that change, and an important part, is not trying to manage what's unmanageable, but just letting it flood us. Hakuin says about this koan, I think, and about many others, and I love this, he'll quote what somebody else says, and so I'll quote it now about his statement that the student is being offered a method to change his very bones. Hakuin says, this statement is terrifying, which I really love, because he was this incredibly fierce teacher, and he's always admitting to the little moment of terror that a lot of the moments in Zen generate for him. So if you're sitting with the Dharmakaya koan and you say to yourself at some point, this statement is terrifying, you're in good comfort, you know, and in good company, I mean, and so it's important to stay there if you can. I think that the koan no is also very much about this, right? A monk asked Xiaozhou, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? Xiaozhou replied, no. And one of the ways we, and then of course, I think we've said this, but that's not a position paper, because a little while later, another monk asks Xiaozhou, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And Xiaozhou just said, yes, of course. You know, so the no is not a disquisition on the problem of dogs, and it's something else. And typically the way we work on it is to ask, what is this no? And one of the ways we do that is just very gently, any thought that comes up, we do no as a kind of mantra. We just do no, no, no. We're not necessarily rejecting that thought, but for right now, we're recognizing it as another attempt to manage or cope, and we're recognizing and lending our allegiance to the notion that the koan is asking us to do something else, that it's asking us not to manage what's unmanageable. One question would be, why bother to do this? And to sort of, I'm going to stop now anyway, so it's not as good a joke as it would be, but what I wanted to say is, just don't worry, we'll get back to that later. You know, why should I bother to sit with this terrifying ritual? Oh, don't worry. But that's very much the tradition. You know, it's like, I'm not going to tell you why you should do it. You know, gradually develop some trust in the process, and let's see what happens. So I'm going to stop there for now, and next time, which might be next week or it might be months from now, I'll try to talk a little bit about working with karmic material in a similar way and with a similar spirit. So thank you very much, and we have a little bit of time, so I would welcome any disagreements, corrections, comments, questions.
When you were talking about, you mentioned courage, and I understand the context in which you were mentioning that. The Christian story, well, I guess it's pre-Christian, the Judaic story about Daniel in the lion's den, everybody remembers the part about the lions, but they forget that the next part was the fire, the ring of fire, and that Daniel only saved himself by walking boldly into the center, You know, if you try to walk around it, approaching it, getting a little too hot, backing off, looking for an entry point, you just slowly cook yourself to death.
Yeah.
But the protection for Daniel was to have the faith and just boom, right?
That's
kind of, is that the same sense that with the koan, you just go into it and just walk into the center of it?
That's great. Yeah, I everybody's different, right? So there's some Daniel who just walks right in and sits down. There's a lot of us who, you know, sort of say, I think I'd like to commit myself to this, but I think I'd like to walk around the circle about 40 times first for about 8 years before I decide. Do you know what I mean? Everybody's got their own pace. And I guess the only thing that, the other metaphor, though, just to switch the metaphors, at least my, you know, some of my experience of it is that, so Daniel goes in, you know, and I guess you, in a way it's like, oh, I realize that I'm there already. I just have to try not to flee, you know? And then, of course, you flee, and then you... One of the great things that John said, I really love this, is he said that he noticed that he spent a lot of time before he had an opening, you know, sort of coming right up to that thing and then getting really scared, and it really pissed him off. And then he realized, and I think this is... He's pretty good psychologically. He said, one of the things I realized I could do then is I could make the subject of my practice just attending to that feeling of being scared and not trying to eradicate it, just watching it. And so that would be part of the kind of purification process, I think. And then since you move from the lion to the fire, I want to move from the fire back to the lion, only I can't remember if it's a lion, but Joan told us one time that there's part of the Chinese tradition is there's an experience of meditation, I think it's the lion.
It's a tiger, that's right.
So it's called being in the tiger's mouth, you know, just letting the tiger kind of chew on you is part of the experience, so yeah.
Thank you.
What's your experience? I mean, do you want to, or
well, yeah. A few years ago, after a very intensive, long, arduous session, that was a wonderful one for me. It was very difficult, but it was a wonderful one for me, as they oftentimes can be. Toward the end of it, I came, I think, very close to a massive breakthrough, and I was terrified. And much to my shame and embarrassment and everlasting regret, I retreated frantically from it. I sabotaged it as well.
Sure.
I did,
yeah, yeah.
You know, snatching defeat out of the jaws of victory.
Yeah.
And it was in the aftermath of that that the story about what I just said about Daniel was presented to me as an image to work on and to think about. And in the intervening years, that was 2000. I think it was 2005 that happened. Of course, now it's 2015, so that was 10 years ago. I have tried to approach a life crisis that you can think of as a koan. And as you're aware, I'm coming out of a major transition.
Yeah.
I've always tried to approach them since then by not trying to run away, not trying to pretend it was something other than what it was, but to sit there and look at it directly. And for me personally, I've just found that it is, okay, this is going to sound contradictory, Buddhism's full of contradictions. It's one of the hardest things to do because every one of your instincts are human social instincts, is to try to obfuscate, minimize, trivialize, fool yourself, deny, add whatever other words you want. And to sit there and just not do any of that is very hard. And yet, at the same time, it turns out to be the easiest thing of all.
That's great.
You understand what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And the bottom line also is that's the only thing that's going to work anyway.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Can I say a few things about that?
But you bringing this up, it was really interesting because I think you're aware of what my situation is. And somehow or other in the last week, the anguish and everything of it has totally fallen away, and I feel free and liberated.
Yeah.
So you bringing this up today is like, how did you know? You've been reading my mail.
Isn't that funny how that happens? Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, that's great. Thank you, Richard.
So
a couple of things. So one version. I know you know this, but so one version of what's scary is I think, you know, partly it's the Kalpa ending fire, and you know, Hakuin says the entire universe was sheer darkness. And Linji said it was like sitting in an ice cave a million miles thick, you know, just there's nothing. But then the Buddha, as he's awakening, asks himself, are you afraid of this happiness? So that's the other part of it, you know, that there's something, the joy of it is kind of like, oh, can I stand this? And so I think we tend to flee from that. And the other thing I want to say, because I think in our peculiar little part of the tradition, you know, the Joan legacy part, there's something that's, I'm going to talk about this in a couple ways quickly. So one is, I remember Joan saying at some point that, and now she's like happier with it again because she, you know, was tired of it for so long, but that she got really tired as a woman teacher about sort of all the phallic imagery of Zen. You know, it's like you have to penetrate into it. You know, you got to be brave. You got to walk right in. And she says, sort of, what about all the other gendered imagery of just sort of being open and receptive and so on? And I actually found that really useful for me, that my experiences of anything that were like that had much less to do with sort of bursting through something than being able to sort of stay there and letting something fill me. And here's another thing that I think is, you know, it's possible this isn't right, but I think one of the, and there's obviously, they're all metaphors, and so they've all got virtues and defects, but one of the possible pitfalls of the sort of walking right into the lion den metaphor for it is that when you're in that moment where things are, you know, typically for me it's in a retreat, but not only, but you know, things are really filling, everything is sort of falling open, everything's falling away, the resistances are not really there, the sense of my narrative is not there so powerfully. There's such a tendency to want to say, this is gonna be it, you know, something's gonna happen, and I just have to do a little more. I'm so close, I just gotta break through.
Oh, I know.
And there's another sense in which the answer would be, you don't have to do anything else. You just stay in the neighborhood. And I also think, you know, Joan quotes this thing that everybody quotes, you know, that enlightenment is an accident, but meditation makes us accident prone. I think in some weird way, it really is accidental, you know, you can be in that moment and you can flee, and we all know what that's like, you know, but somehow it's a little bit serendipitous whether we flee. Right, you know, it's like, oh, we fled, or we don't know why. And also, sometimes we don't flee, and nothing happens, and sometimes it does. So I think, to some extent, you know, just sort of saying, I'm going to be here, and, you know, just try not to go away. That I think that's important. There's also a sense that, so just to contradict that, there's sometimes a sense that in those moments, you get a hunch that if you do something a little bit, you're going to make one choice about how you're going to sit in that moment rather than another. And I know for me, one time I was working on no, and I was doing no as a kind of mantra, you know, and then I was sort of tinkering with it. Oh, what if I did this? What if I did that? So this is both not doing something and doing something. So I said, I got to stop doing that, but I'm just going to do no really, really intensely, you know? So I don't know, you get some hunches about how you can do it.
But those hunches can be self-deceptive.
I know. Yeah. Yeah.
Lying to yourself to run away.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things I think is that it's a real mistake, like, to find that you're in the neighborhood and nothing happened that you were hoping was going to happen, and so you get down on yourself and say, I must have fucked it up. I mean, it's also like, oh, better luck next time, partly. Do you know? And to regard it as sort of partly serendipitous and beyond your control, I think it's also useful. And if you think it's all on you, then there's some pitfalls to that. But I mean, there's no right answer.
What you said about Joan's comment about the phallic imagery, that's interesting. I've not heard that before, but it rings true. I mean, I brought up the imagery of walking through the ring of fire.
Yeah.
But in my own case, the way I do it now, it's interesting. All I mean by walking through the ring of fire is just throwing away the distractions that would allow, you know, go check Facebook instead. But when I sit and face the thing, it's more like staring it down. It's like sitting in front of the tiger, to use a tiger. And then at some point, it doesn't cease to be a tiger, because whatever crisis you're facing is a crisis you're facing, and it needs to be dealt with on some level. But it's as though the malevolence of the tiger somehow dissolves, and you realize that the tiger isn't your problem. The tiger isn't your enemy. You know, that you can, a wrong image perhaps, but that you can just get up and walk past it and just give it a pat on the head as you walk past it and deal with what has to be done.
Yeah. The other one is that sense, I know we're over time, but you know that, it's like a donkey looking at a well. And the teacher says, that's about 80%. What's the other 20%? It's like a well looking at a donkey.
I know that one.
So you're staring that thing down. And one of the things that can happen is...
You're blending with.
Yeah. Oh, it's, and also it's looking at you. It's aware of you. And then maybe it isn't the tiger.
Yeah.
We're over time. I'm sorry. Any other just last comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you. So there are chant cards.